Joining us now is Joshua Gans. Joshua is a professor of strategic management at the University of Toronto. He's chief economist at the University of Toronto's Creative Destruction Lab, and he's author of the excellent new book, The Disruption Dilemma. Joshua, welcome to Innovation Navigation.
Oh, good to be here.
So we have had a lot of authors of disruption books on our show, and I got to say I was kind of dreading reading your book, and then I read it and was pleasantly surprised. It's an excellent book. I recommend it to anybody. But I want to ask you, why another book on disruption? Why did you feel the need to add to the literature on disruption?
So the last thing I wanted to do was add to the noise. I had felt the same frustration you had. I would roll my eyes every time I saw a new disruption book or anyone really saying the word itself, partly because it was just everywhere. Everything was being disrupted or was going to disrupt or somebody was going to disrupt or whatever, and it was all a bit much. But what was interesting is that since Clay Christensen came up with the term disruption pretty much 20 years ago now, there had not been actually amongst those books ones that had actually tried to report on the research that had been done by academics such as myself and yourself as well on these types of issues. And that was quite interesting because, you know, Clay Christensen's book started with that. It was out of his PhD thesis. One of the reasons why it took off is that it was on the basis of studies he had conducted. But at the same time, you know, people have done 20 years of research, and for most of these books, it was as if no one had ever cracked open an academic journal. Now, there's often a good reason for that. Academic journals tend to be written for other academics, which is not the best audience. But one of the frustrations that we had was, you know, what do I give my students to talk about this? Everybody is talking about disruption, and I don't want to give them another book that says 10 ways that you can be a disruptor tomorrow. What I wanted to give a book was, well, what do we really know about this thing? And so what I did in this book was I went back all the way to Clay Christensen and the question he was asking. And he wasn't asking, you know, is the world being disrupted and is everything turbulent? He asked actually a very simple question, and it's right on the front of his book, is how is it that good and very successful companies end up failing? And this was the real provocative idea at the heart of it. It was that, you know, we all know that badly managed companies can fail. We know that some badly managed companies don't fail quickly enough. But what Clay Christensen really brought out there was that you could have companies that were following every single good management practice, listening to their customers, having product development teams that were focused on innovation, not doing stupid things like fraud or poor compliance or anything like that. And those companies could be riding high and then only a few years later seem to be in existential trouble.
And one of the problems, not problems, but one of the sources of misunderstanding about disruption from that Harvard crowd's standpoint is that they took a very specific definition of disruption. That disruption is a lower-end technology that initially provides less benefit to some underserved segment, but over time improves very rapidly and ends up surprising the incumbents. And that's fine, and I think, you know, he captured something very interesting there. But the problem is that there's lots of other things that when we think about what the word disrupt really means, there's lots of other businesses that have been disrupted. And one of the many things I like about your book is that you've broadened that definition of disruption. So how are you defining disruption?
Right. So you are correct. Clay Christensen identified a very simple story as to how a good firm could fail. And his story was that the firm was doing the right thing on the demand side of its business. It was listening to its customers. Some new product comes along that perhaps has you know, some new features, but, you know, isn't necessarily the right thing for, you know, that firm's existing customers. So if the firm asks their customers, you know, do you want a phone with a touch screen rather than a keyboard? And the customers say, no, I like the keyboard. And the firms go back and say, you know, we heard from the customers, they like the keyboard, we like the keyboard too, we should keep doing that. Now, as it turns out, there are other elements that allow the phone, for instance, in this case, to develop new features such that the customers change their mind. And so Christensen's story was, well, you could get into trouble by listening to your customers so intensely, and this was the mechanism by which that occurred. Now, the big thing about that is, yes, that can occur. Yes, that can be a problem for you. But was that going to really cause you to your business to fail? And when academics have looked at that, it hasn't happened. That story sounds sensible, but actually the customer-focused firms have had some time to switch gears and save themselves. They have some rocky times. I know you talked a bit earlier about Lego, and that certainly is a good example of that. But eventually they pulled themselves up. You know, there are some examples to the contrary, but that's how it occurs. The real stress, and this occurred, predated Christensen in the Harvard literature, is that when you had a supply-side threat to disruption. And the way that story, you know, the disruptive threat, and the way that story goes is like this. You organize your team to develop products that are very, very innovative. You want to continually beat the competition. You want to continually improve how that product works and how the individual components perform. So if you had a mobile phone, you want to make sure it's got a really good radio, so you've got a good signal. You want to make sure that keyboard lasts longer. You want to make sure it has great battery life, all those sorts of things. And so what you do, and this is what good product development would say, is you want to, once you understand that those are the things you want to put teams on it that are super focused on improving those individual components. And the reason you want to do that is, goes all the way back to Adam Smith, there is a gain from specialization and having a division of labor, not only within your firm, but also within how your firm develops new products and improves its products over time.
So, Joshua, give us an example of a product like that, something that would be a supply-side disruption that maybe Christensen wouldn't consider a disruption.
Well, so I've already mentioned the mobile phone, so let me do that. The one thing that Christensen has had trouble with, and he admits this fully, was the iPhone. When the iPhone first was announced in 2007, there were interesting set of reactions to it. The reactions from the incumbents in the industry, the Microsofts, the Motorolas, the Nokias, and the RIM, who produced BlackBerry, were, you know, this is all very well, but, you know, no one really wants a phone like this. It seems very different from other phones. We have enough trouble teaching people to use our phones. And the RIM people said, "Oh, people love our keyboard." And other people said, "Well, you know, I don't think Apple have what it takes to really produce the right components that are going to do this." And Christensen at that time looked at it and said, well, you know, I think the reason that Apple's going to have trouble with the iPhone is because it isn't really truly disruptive. If it's going to appeal to someone, it's more highly priced. People are going to see it as a sexy new phone. It might have a few extra capabilities like surfing the net or being able to listen to your music. That doesn't make it a disruptive innovation. It's not one of these innovations that looks like it was a poor competitor, a low-end competitor. In fact, it's very, very high-end. It is something that is appealing to a niche group of customers. That's not a disruptive innovation. That's the sort of innovation that incumbents generally can react to and improve upon.
Right.
And
what Michael Rayner in Michael Rayner's one of Clay Christensen's co-authors, what he calls a bar fight, right?
Yes.
It's not a disruption. It's a bar fight. You've got two high-end competitors slugging it out for these few customers that are willing to pay a lot for a phone. And so, right, Christensen famously predicted that it was not going to be successful.
That's
so,
right.
Okay. So
now we know. We know, and he knows, and everybody knows that was a poor prediction. But it was a prediction that was actually quite consistent with his demand side view of disruption. This did not fit that story. But let's actually go back and think about this from the point of view of the supply side. What happens in supply-side disruption, remember, is that you have incumbent firms who are very, very good at producing better and better at components. And if you think about what a phone used to look like, and we're going back less than 10 years, it was a fairly centered device. It either had a numeric keypad, which people used to actually text on that. That's what the teenagers used to do. Or it would have a actual physical keyboard, which is, of course, what BlackBerry pioneered. And moreover, and it's also very hard to remember, but that BlackBerry keyboard was incredibly successful. I mean,
I loved it.
Everybody loved it. They called it the Crackberry. People couldn't get enough of it. But it was also a phenomenal piece of engineering. It is very, very hard to make a keyboard that can sustain that amount of thumb punishment and just work perfectly and work in a way that isn't frustrating. I mean, so much so that we've got Hillary Clinton, you know, the reason she had her own email server was so that she could continue to use a BlackBerry. So, I mean, you know, people will go to extraordinary lengths to keep that. So in that regard, the RIM people and also Nokia and so on, you know, they took the iPhone when it first appeared, cracked it open and said, well, there's nothing special here. You know, they handle all the teams. Is there anything special in the battery? No. Is there anything special in the radio? No. Is there anything special in this touchscreen? They thought, not even that. That could be dealt with. And so they basically said, you know, we can catch up to this. And in RIM's case, in the BlackBerry, they actually made some attempts to do so. They actually released, 18 months after the iPhone, their own touchscreen version and things like that. But as it turned out, if we look back now, we know that in fact this is, you know, if disruption is the failure of successful firms, then all of the handset makers who were leading the charge in 2008 and 2009 failed. I mean, you know, they pop it around in some capacity, but they failed. In fact, now the industry is owned by new entrants, Apple and Samsung, and some others as well.
But you argue in the book in a really interesting way that it actually wasn't Apple that disrupted RIM, that RIM sales after the iPhone was introduced actually went up, that they did better. Who did disrupt RIM?
So basically, the way it goes is this, is two steps. The first step is what Apple were able to do was they didn't develop any new components, nothing special, but they put it together differently. And they also integrated it into software in a way that hadn't been done. So the only firm that looked at Apple and said, oh my gosh, this is important, was of course Google. Google's reaction to the iPhone was they were previously producing a phone with a keyboard and they said, oh my God, this is not what we can do. We have to just scrap this entire team and start over because this design, and we know what phones look like now, they're basically a brick, right? This design and how they interact is the future of phones. And so what Google did was, of course, produce the Android operating system and then licensed that, gave it away essentially to other manufacturers. And that allowed the second step, is that the Android phones dramatically decreased the price of these smartphones. Apples were always at the high end, and they still are today. In fact, they've dropped a little last week, but but they still are the high end phones. But Android phones were much, much cheaper. And so basically what occurred was that you ended up having a requiring new entrants to come in who understood that they were building an entirely new phone and that how the parts fit together had changed completely. And also, they had to realize that they were trying to do it competitively. And so that changed this from a bar fight into a rout.
We are talking with Joshua Ganz. He's a professor of strategic management at the University of Toronto, and he's also author of the new book, The Disruption Dilemma. So, Joshua, if I had to summarize what you're saying, you're even more depressing than Clay Christensen in that what Clay says is that, you know, our customers often, when new technology emerges, will push us away from that technology, and so we'll get blindsided by it. What you're saying is that also it can be really hard, even if we realize the opportunity is there, to get our own company to execute on it. And so even if we're able to avoid the Christensen type of disruption, we still may not be able to respond. So let's move around to the positive side of your book. I mean, I've lost count of how many managers have told me that, you know, somebody listened to Christensen and they started a new group whose job it is to disrupt their own company. They staff it with the best and brightest. They, you know, they put in the comfy sofas and the whiteboards with post-its all over the place, and they're told to reinvent the future. And 2 or 3 years later, nothing's happened. The group is shut down. The sofas are hauled away, and the net effect is to poison the well. You know, when a real threat comes along, it's harder to respond to it. What should companies do?
Well, so the response that you talked about was the, you know, if our problem is that we're listening to our customers too much, let's invent a team that doesn't do that.
That's true, right?
So yeah. it gives us the option. And you know, this is the mantra of self-disruption, and Christensen himself pushes that quite strongly.
Right.
I have to admit, myself, I've never, that's never made sense to me, but it wasn't until the book that I really investigated it. And it didn't make sense because this idea of, even if you could disrupt yourself, you have to choose what to disrupt yourself with is, because these alternative ideas can come from anywhere, and the chances of you picking the right one are very, very low. And in the process, you can really make mistakes. One company that I think made a mistake was Google. Google saw a potential disruptive threat from Facebook in that social data would be very useful in search and may end up disrupting it from that, which is a sound theory. But it ended up dealing with that by setting up almost a separate division, Google Plus, and, you know, trying to lead the organization through that. And that turned out to be a dramatic failure. And it also turned out to be predicated on an assumption that Facebook were going to disrupt it that may be incorrect. In other words, the worst thing you can do is presume that something is going to kill you, kill yourself first, and it turns out to be incorrect.
Josh, you're making me even more depressed. Let's come around to Lego. How about that? That we were talking with Mike Psyche, who's a designer at Lego, and Lego's getting disrupted in any number of ways, like Minecraft and other online construction environments give player unlimited blocks for essentially free, and 3D printers are making it possible to print your own Lego bricks for much less than Lego, and there's massively multiplayer games that let you build things together with other people on adventures. If you were talking to the CEO of Lego, what advice would you give him?
So I think, you know, from my point of view, so Lego is this company that has certainly stood the test of time, and you know, and while it has had some turbulent issues associated with it, it really has an important position within, you know, the sort of toy industry and people's lives, including my own. I'm a huge Lego fan myself, so the advice to Lego, you know, it's easier to think about Lego 10 years ago, you know, before you wrote your book on this, you know, Lego 10, 15 years ago was in trouble. What it was doing was, you know, doing what it always had done, but it also was very closed company. It didn't listen to its customers. It didn't engage with adult fans of Lego. It didn't even engage in children. I have a colleague who, His kid, you know, did this beautiful design for these pyramids and sent them to Lego. And the response he got was a whole set of legal documents saying, don't infringe on the Lego name. You can't do any of this. You know, the Lego of today isn't that. The Lego of today now goes out and, you know, realizes people are coming up with designs, realizes that, that some of their users, are, their lead users, are great sources of information. And so what it has done is it has integrated itself into its customer base more than before. I bet you, and you, maybe you know, I bet you these Lego idea sets that get produced that are designed by people are terrible, terrible profit makers. They don't do, you know, I compared to what they can do themselves, I bet you they're just terribly difficult and they would not choose to do so. But they are a great source of new ideas coming into the company. They're a great source of what their customers are most committed to building and would most get excited about. And so from that point of view, they're a source of information. Now, the companies that ride out this, you know, potential disruption, and they exist, invariably choose not to do something like self-disrupt, which is basically to let's set up an independent division away from everything else, silo it off and fight. Instead, they get closer together. They make sure their product development teams are always reminded of their roots. So even if you're focusing on a particular component, you have people in those teams or people who traverse around them who remind where those components fit in with other ones. And so companies like that are the ones that are going to be able to ride these disruptive waves. Now, I won't say with Lego, something new won't come along and that'll be it. But, you know, when you get a presence in when you're in the toy aisle and you've crossed generations, you've really got a good position there. And really, it's a market for you to lose. and so long as Lego continues to understand, you know, that its customers have some evolving needs and things like that, I think it will be just fine. So I'm not depressed about those possibilities.
Okay, so it really is a collaboration with the potential disruptors, right? Form a partnership with these game makers or with your leading edge fans is one way to respond.
I think they find their bits. I mean, you know, one thing's, Lego have been very successful in moving into video games. Now, if you had asked anybody, you know, you want to move into video games? Are you crazy? I mean, you can't do that. What have you got there? You're all about physical bricks. But they move into video games because the video games themselves are true to the customers that Lego are after. And they're true in the sense that they always have a building element to it. They always have the, you know, they're
the minifigure,
Lego.
Yeah.
Right? And moreover, they're even better than that. You know, when I was thinking about games to play with my kids, you know, they like to shoot things, but, you know, adult games have blood. Lego games, you shoot someone and they just fall into a bunch of bricks.
Entirely appropriate. Joshua, I hate to say it, but we're out of time. We've been talking with Joshua Ganz. He's professor of strategic management at the University of Toronto, chief economist at the Creative Destruction Lab, and author of the new book, Disruption Dilemma. Joshua, thanks for coming on Innovation Navigation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.